Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're here to talk about the spoilers for the final season of Game of Thrones for this first day, in whatever capacity you could possibly have spoilers based on source material that doesn't exist at this point. We're going to try to do that.
There's still a big one, and it's one that we... Well, I mean, there's lots of stuff to talk about, obviously. But there's one that we didn't talk about, the Valonqar theory. You've heard of this several times, Jim. If I had to ask you to recite it, what would you say to the...
It's essentially the prophecy that either Jaime or Tyrion is going to kill Cersei in the end. It translates roughly to little brother, and that's part of the prophecy that Maggie the Frog gave to Cersei when she was young, that she would be killed by this younger brother.
Yeah, there's the Maggie the Frog scene. It was in a couple seasons ago where a young Cersei found out, you know, she went to this soothsayer, this woods witch, and asked her, you know, will I be queen? She says, oh yeah, you'll be queen, and you'll have three children. Your husband, the king, will have scores of children, and you'll have the three, and golden will be their crowns, and gold will be their shrouds, and till a younger queen, more beautiful than you, supplants you, that's where the show prophecy ends. The book continues and says, and when your tears have drowned you, the Valonqar shall wrap his hands around your pale white throat and choke the life from you. And as Jim said, Valonqar is a word that means little brother. In I believe it's Valyrian. It might have been Bravosi. So that... In the books, Cersei is obsessed with the idea that this is Tyrion. And, you know, we see a little bit of that in the shows where obviously she has more reasons than this just to be angry at Tyrion. He murdered her father. She suspects him of murdering her son. But she's on full Valonqar alert, and she's hiring people. Like there's a price for... You can bring a dwarf's head to King's Landing and get, like, a couple gold dragons for it. And she's searching for him. She's got assassins out looking for him. So he's the very popular theory. Also, Tyrion has choked the life out of a woman before, in both the show and the book. So it's not like, you know, him wrapping his hands around throats and choking is, he's got some experience, but it's like what Cersei expects is kind of like the plain reading of the prophecy. So a lot of people found it unsatisfying. There's a couple other candidates, Jaime. Jaime is technically Cersei's younger brother because she popped out of their mother first, like by several minutes. So he also...
And you better believe she plays that card all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm the oldest, Jaime. What the fuck do you know? So that would obviously be pretty dramatically satisfying, right? You
know. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's the only woman he's ever really loved, and he has... kind of adored her, and he's done a lot of bad things kind of in her name to protect the relationship. Him choking the life out of her for would pay off dramatically in a lot of obvious ways. Then if we go outside the actual literal little brother, like little brother to the Cersei, you've got the Hound. He's the little brother to, of course, Gregor Clegane. He's on roughly the good guy's side. But is there any dramatic satisfaction to the Hound choking Cersei?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be no more or less important to him than any other people that he's probably murdered over the course of his life. How about Bran? Bran's a little brother.
Yeah, I mean, aren't 50% of all siblings younger? Well, no, I guess... Roughly 25%.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
There are
that
a lot of damn
out.
Little brothers on this planet. I don't know. As far as like being satisfying narratively, I just don't see Bran, you know, mixing himself up in the sort of problems of or the solutions of mere mortals at this point.
But
is he going to choke Cersei to death?
You didn't see the line where he met the three-eyed crow and he says, will I walk again? He goes, no, but you'll choke the shit out of Cersei Lannister. You didn't hear that?
Maybe that was on the season?
Maybe that's on the Blu-rays.
Is that five?
That could have been a cut scene.
Yeah, probably was. I would imagine that's cut.
Now... Here is an out there theory that a lot of people have been kind of bandying about. Arya. And there's two ways to look at this.
Okay.
We already have, and some of this gets in like biblical numerology bullshit.
Oh,
it's like,
boy.
Because Azor Ahai, we know that that was possibly mistranslated because it refers to dragons, and dragons are sexless, and therefore it's not necessarily the prince that was promised, but it could have been the princess that was promised. Well, this is another word that could have been translated. Maybe everything's as loosey-goosey and is not supposed to be gendered, and maybe this could be a female or in addition to being a male.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, that's like if you think that Martin's going to play the same linguistic trick twice, then, you know, that's fine. But there's also the possibility that Arya is wearing a little brother's face.
Sure.
And that is where things get interesting. If Jaime dies and she takes his face, or if Tyrion dies and she takes his face and chokes the shit out of Cersei, because she's obviously on her list.
Well, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is theorizing, you know, coming up with the coolest ideas they can think of and then putting them out there on the internet. And then everybody latches onto them and goes, yes, this is super cool.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's not just the plain reading of it. It's not just the way it could go. By doing that, don't we sort of diminish the reveal of that?
I mean, the goal, it seems like what the internet wants is
something they can't think of, but that's not possible.
They want something that's hidden in plain sight, but yet mm-hmm. no one on the internet can think of and put on the internet so that everyone knows it.
And yet George Martin and the Double D's are supposed to be able to come up with this their own.
And every once in a while that happens, and that's the gold standard that everyone chases.
Good luck.
But I mean, and some
this
people,
series has been so analyzed
that
I find it almost impossible to believe that that's going to happen.
And some people think that, since this wasn't in the show, that's telling that it's not going to be that important to the plot. And I'm like, I don't know, because I would be, if George ever finishes these books and the person that kills Cersei Lannister is different in the show than the books, that's one of the like bullet points I don't think he would like. I think he's pretty fucking satisfied with how that works out in his head, and he's just mm-hmm. trying to get there. Like, it would shock me if, like, Tyrion strangles him in one book and Bran strangles her in the TV show. So even though it's not in the TV show, I think you can still, it's valid to look at this prophecy in the book and say, like, well, to the extent that this is informing George's opinion.
Yeah.
Now, it could also be that George is trying to make the point that a lot of this prophecy is kind of self-fulfilled. Like, Cersei's maniacal focus on avoiding these prophecies coming true is in large part caused the conditions that have allowed her children to die and her brothers to hate her and all these other things. So it's like, it could be that, like, it doesn't even, this last part that hasn't come true yet won't ever. And the joke is that, you know, if Cersei had not let this prophecy dominate her life, you know, she would have been better off and none of this would have, the tragedy befell her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Any other thoughts on the Valonqar before we have another Jaime tangent?
I do think, I guess that Arya is a good compromise, you know, between something that we can't think of, but something that's awesome.
Yeah, Arya wearing a face.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be at least one more of the
because we know she has to check off that list, right? At least Cersei off that list.
And
do it with someone's face who's important to her and it would be meaningful.
Yeah.
I think that makes it worthwhile.
And she did it with the phrase, but like to me that's, I mean, this isn't a trick in the same way, like a plot device trick. Like, it's no more a trick than Brienne being really good with her sword, you know? It's like, oh, well, Brienne won a fight with a sword. What's the odds of George going to have her win another fight with the sword? Like, very high. That's Brienne's thing.
Uh-huh.
Arya's thing is she's this blood-fueled magic ninja. So she's going to do blood-fueled magic ninja shit in this last season. And ripping off Daddy Frey's face is just like a foregleam of that.
Oh,
you know?
I would do face stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah. Just
all
to fuck with people.
All the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have to kill whoever's face I wanted, which is a downside, admittedly, but I don't
know. Imagine if you get a hold of Ramsay's face, and every morning at the breakfast table, Theon comes down and Arya's sitting there wiggling a sausage at him. Like, Arya's a real dick sometimes.
I don't know if Sansa would stand for that.
Before we move on to other topics, I want to do a little bit of bald move housekeeping here, because there's a lot of stuff we're doing, some of it in connection to Game of Thrones. For example, we have a Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy that's going on right now, where we're picking each week a different movie, classic movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and early aughts, a fantasy movie involving swords and dragons and magic. This week's is Conan the Barbarian. We had a lot of fun. For club members, we actually do a live watch of the movie with commentary by Jim and I, and we also do a deep dive into the to the movie on our podcast. You can find that on the Bald Movies feed. If you go to iTunes or Google Play or your favorite podcast app and search for Bald Movies, they'll come right up. Please subscribe to that if you want to get if you want to enjoy a fantasy movie experience along with us. We also, don't forget, have exclusive House Snow pin designs at pin-y.com. You can show your allegiance to the King of the North, the once and future King of Westeros, perhaps, by going to pin-y and check it out. The House Snow We Know Nothing pins. Don't forget, I wrote two books. I'm going to be referring to them throughout probably this fucking podcast series. GodsOfThrones.com. If you'd like to get a copy, there's direct links to the Amazon stuff in our show notes. And we are also on Twitch.tv, twitch.tv/baldmove. Jim and I do like our TV prep where we watch like trailers and decide what we're going to be talking about on Bald Move TV each week. And Cecily and I play Mario games, and Jim's plays games that are occasionally. We're trying to get like some 3 and 4 people things going. So if that sounds good, go to twitch.tv/baldmove, sub, so you know when we go online, because we don't have like the strictest schedule. But some people have asked about that, and we're having a pretty good time doing it. Twitch.tv/baldmove.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Mm-hmm. Mike R., would it be crazy if Jamie's arc came full circle and he went from Kingslayer to Queenslayer, taking out both father and daughter? She's already showing several mad queenish tendencies. Jamie impaling her with some Valyrian steel from behind would open up the path for John to take his rightful seat on the throne with a clear conscience. John's already proven he's incapable of killing a woman he loves, no matter the warranting circumstances. It would be awesome to see Jamie get to protect an honorable king for once while finally serving with a sense of honor himself. I mean, he could become the Queenslayer just by killing if he ends up being a Valonqar, then he's got the whole set, king, queen, and kinslayer. Bam, bam, bam.
Yeah. He tried to go for the quad kill with Bran, but it just didn't quite work out for him.
Yeah. I do think he tried to, he only half killed him. He only killed the feeling below his belly button.
and whatever part of him was human.
Do you think that, I think that if Dany turns out to be some kind of mad queen, evil person, that the odds of Jaime being the one killer are pretty high because it just does make so much dramatic sense.
It's so satisfying, dramatically and narratively.
Like him killing the father, him killing the daughter, them both turning rogue and being bad for the people. Like I said, I don't think there's a really high chance that Dany's going to be tested in that way, in the same way Luke Skywalker was tested, but I think she's going to... Unlike, what's the opposite of I'm not a crazy person like my father before me? Because Luke reaffirmed that he's a Jedi. If Dany did that, she'd reaffirm she's a crazy person. So we'll see. Like I said, if this goes down like that, then the chances of that would be high. But I just don't think the chances of her going mad are all particularly high. I saw the best theory I saw kind of online, best new theory, was posted on Reddit's A Song of Ice and Fire forum, r/ASOAIAF. It's A Song of Ice and Fire, and I'm dyslexic, sue me, by Coupon. And it was entitled My Night King is Not Stupid Theory. Okay? So his... What he has to say is, when the army of the undead line up for the Battle of Winterfell, the Night King and his zombie dragon will not be there. Instead, he will already be flying to his next target, King's Landing. So the theory is essentially that the Night King is going to fork his forces. He's going to take the army of the dead and meet Jon and Dany head on at Winterfell. But because he knows that if he takes his dragon there, his weapon of mass destruction, it's going to be a 2-on-1 dragon on dragon. And he's got a presumably very flammable dragon now, one little lick of dragon fire. And this thing's going to go up like the Hindenburg. And the Night King knows this. So what he's going to do is he's going to let his army of the dead grind out the living and this army of attrition, and then he's going to sack King's Landing just with himself and the dragon, and then turn another huge undead army. So the horror facing Jon and Dany is ultimately emerging bloodied and victorious at Winterfell and realizing they have to do it all over again at King's Landing.
Yeah. The only thing I don't like about that is that Cersei's at King's Landing. And it's not satisfying if the Night King on a dragon takes Cersei out.
Okay.
She would have to escape King's Landing and come maybe crawling back to the armies of Winterfell and say, yep, yeah, I fucked up. Let's do this thing. And then someone kill her there.
I kind of thought that, but the more I thought about it, the more I kind of liked the fact that Cersei was so sure that she could just sit in King's Landing and let everybody else do her fighting for them.
It's fine from that perspective, but I think everything we talked about with the Valonqar, everything we've talked about with narrative satisfaction from Jaime or Arya, all of that is lost in there.
What if I told you the Night King was the little brother of the first child of the forest?
Okay.
Uh-huh. And he's got a real axe to grind.
I'm back on board.
He's got a real axe to grind against the older sisters.
Yeah, not as satisfying for me. I'm not saying it won't go that way. It's just not as narratively dramatically satisfying.
There's a couple of things that so this theory isn't just it's not just your normal run of the mill. Wouldn't it be cool? He actually has a couple of textual and visual supports here. During season 4, where Bran was going north to meet the Three-Eyed Crow in the first place, there's a scene where he touches a weirwood and he's treated to all these crazy visions. One of them is a destroyed throne room, and there's a massive shadow of a dragon that passes over it.
Mm-hmm.
And
could also be living dragons.
Could also be living.
Yeah.
But, But also, showing the shadow is kind of brilliant, because if they showed the dragon itself, we could be like, well, that's not the that's not undead Viserion. Right. Yeah. But the shadow kind of keeps it ambiguous. Also, when Danny goes to the House of the Undying in season two, at the climax of the "Where are my dragons?" plot, she has a series of crazy images. One of them is a destroyed throne room where there is either ash or snow falling.
Yeah.
And so, like, that, again, if it's snow, it could be, you know, that would mean that winter has advanced all the way to King's Landing by the end of this, and so this is one way it could work out. Also, interesting note that if we really analyze that vision literally, Dany, like, reaches for the Iron Throne, but comes short, just short of touching it. And you know what the Iron Throne is covered in?
Ash.
Well, if it's snow, it's covered in snow.
Okay.
A.K.A. Jon Snow, A.K.A. Aegon Targaryen, A.K.A. the rightful king of Winter... Yeah, Winterfell. Westeros. Westeros fell.
Sure.
He's gonna rename the whole damn continent to he's no longer going to be King's Land. It's going to be...
Winteros?
It's going to be Westeros fell.
Oh, boy.
I thought that was... I think that it's going to be a more conventional thing than that, but it would be kind of cool if they did that kind of feint. But you're right. There's a couple weaknesses of it just thematically.
I know this bittersweet idea kind of throws all that into confusion, right? You don't have to have the most satisfying thing.
Right.
If it's bittersweet, you can also have some things that are dissatisfying. So who knows?
I got together with Anthony, the guy who helped me write, or we co-authored the Gods of Thrones book together, because we were going to do like this thing where we get together and talk some topics and record like 5 minutes of stuff and put it in a podcast, but had some problem with the audio. The audio on my end sounded like I was a Terminator gargling acid. So I'm not going to be able to drop it in there, but I want to summarize the points because I thought there's some interesting things that tie in some of the lore aspects that tie in with this episode, because this introduced the idea that Dany's dragons don't like the North. And something that Anthony and I found out in our research and our discussion of Fire and Blood that we did last year, George Martin's new Targaryen history, is Dany's not the first Targaryen queen that took her dragons through the wall. There's Queen Alysanne, who took her dragons on kind of a tour of the kingdom, and she went to stay at Castle Black as the guest of the Black Brothers and kind of showed off the dragons. And I'm just going to quote from Fire and Blood here. It says, "The men of the Night's Watch were as thunderstruck by the Queen's dragon as the people of White Harbor had been, though the Queen herself noted that Silverwing, which is her dragon, quote-unquote, does not like this wall. Though it was summer and the wall was weeping, the chill of the ice could still be felt whenever the wind blew, and every gust would make the dragon hiss and snap." The queen says, "Thrice I flew Silverwing high above Castle Black, and thrice I tried to take her north beyond the wall," Alysanne wrote to Jaehaerys, her husband, the king. "But every time she veered back south again and refused to go. Never before has she refused to take me where I wish to go. I laughed about it when I came down again, so the Black Brothers would not realize anything was amiss. But it troubled me then, and it troubles me still." Now, the context of this being released, George actually published this a month or two before the book came out on his Not a Blog, Gurm's Not a Blog, and at the end of September. But this was after the show took the dragons north of the wall.
Yeah, that was the first thing that popped in my head.
So,
it's been done.
Now, there's a couple of interesting possibilities if we try to take this holistically, that like Gurm had in one of his bullet points that maybe the closer you get to the Night's King, or the closer you get to the wall, the closer you get to the North, that the dragons, like, power is going to reduce. Because, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, well, Dany's got dragons, the Night King's got an army that's made out of balsa wood soaked in gasoline. This is not going to be a contest. But if the dragons have some kind of weakness that would like sap their strength or energy, maybe that would make them put the fight on a fair footing. And this is the Double D's trying to introduce that concept.
Yeah, but there was no weakness shown.
No, not previously.
As far as I can tell, yeah.
It's just I'm trying to square the circle between what, because the other thing is, it's entirely possible that George had something in there and then he continues to garden it. Now,
sure,
there's like,
yeah,
there's like a two-way magical barrier. The Night King can't come south and the dragons can't come north. It's like that old, do you remember when McDonald's had this sandwich that came in this massive styrofoam container, and it had a bun and the hot dog on one side, and then the other bun and all of the like vegetables on the other. And its marketing gimmick was it keeps the hot side hot and the cold side cold.
No.
So the wall's a giant styrofoam container keeping the hot side hot and the cold side cold. The other is that, like, I don't know, because it's kind of a dick move for George to use this to publicize his book, and it's essentially canonical fact, dragons cannot fly north of the wall.
Yeah, the show fucked up, guys.
Yeah.
Is what he's saying.
And I don't know, because I've heard a bunch of different ways whether, like, you know, the D&D and George's relationship is kind of frosted. And maybe it's not even frosted, maybe just awkward because everybody's kind of bummed out, but, like, I don't know. You see stuff like that and you kind of wonder. But it could be that, like, because, you know, we suggested Danny's dragons are missing their brothers, or maybe they just don't like the cold because they're creatures of fire. But it could be that maybe there is some kind of long-term weakness that's being split here. Maybe that's why the Night King lured them north of the wall, because he knew they'd be weakened enough that he could spear one and snag it. I don't know. I'm speculating, but
yeah,
that's one point I want to talk about. Also, one of her last chapters in her Gods of Thrones book is called The Weirdification of Bran Stark, and we delve into some psychological research and theories of the mind. I think it's not controversial to say that what we call our consciousness, or like the person of Jim and Aeron, is essentially the sum total of our memories, right? If your memories were completely wiped, would you be the same person?
I'm sure we'll get a philosophy student writing in.
I hope so.
To tell us where we're wrong on that.
I hope
but
so.
But that sounds a reasonable assumption, sure.
You need to buy the book so you can quote chapter and verse so you can really show us up. That'd be. I don't want anybody to do that. That'd be hell for me. But so if a person is a collection of memories, and if your memories were wiped, you wouldn't be the same person. That Bran is kind of like the exact opposite of that. That Bran has, if we understand his situation correctly, all human and potentially all humanoid memory of Westeros going back to like the literal dawn of time, like the children's memories, the giants' memories, any kind of sentient creature that's done things in witness of the Weirwood Network, or whose green seers have merged with the Weirwood Network. And, like, that Bran's weird affect is a result of, like, he's not Bran anymore. He's, like, everyone all the time, constantly.
And maybe the more he accesses those memories and understands them, the less Bran he becomes.
Yeah. And the fact also that those green seers may still be, because there's points in the book where there's a warg that dies while he is inside. Like, they call it their second life, that you merge with your consciousness as you die, and your consciousness is kind of trapped as a ghost inside this animal until it dies. But in the Weirwood, in the books, the Weirwood are immortal. Like, unless you cut one down, a Weirwood will never die. If you do cut them down, the Weirwood bark the bark and wood never rots. It's like this like semi-magical property. So in these Weirwood trees, these ghosts could just be echoing around. There's just like this sea of ghosts echoing forever in these trees, and another reason for Bran to be weird.
You need to start making some bridges out of that stuff.
If
it never rots, let's do that.
I feel like it's one of those things where, like, the Andals and the First Men should have been a lot more circumspect about what they cut down and just burnt. It's like I don't know, if everyone destroyed all the uranium in the earth 500 years ago, it's like, fuck, this was really important.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you like that, there's a lot more of stuff like that than godsofthrones.com, and there's links to purchase the books in the show notes. All right. I decided I'm not going to do a stealth ad. I'm just going to try to value add content. I'm going to try to do the stuff the quote unquote right way. Okay, back to some more feedback. Leslie T has a couple of thoughts after she listened to our various podcasts, kicking things off. And one spoiler from a few years ago, a listener asked you guys how many of the leader White Walkers there were. Aaron mentioned that the most we'd ever seen in one episode where Craster's baby was turned, he noted that there were either 12 or 13. In another podcast, Aaron explained the story of the last hero to Jim, mentioning that the last hero, so this is one of the various Azor Ahai theories across the globe of Planetos, mentioning that the last hero had 12 companions when he journeyed north during the Long Night. During Season 6, Episode 5, Bran sees the Children of the Forest create the first White Walker, and the actor playing that man looks a lot like the actor who plays the Night King. In fact, it's the same actor. So I'm not sure, or I'm sure I'm not the first person to make these connections, but could the Night King and his other leaders be the last hero, a.k.a. Azor Ahai and his companions? Could he have been cursed by the Night King until the next long night, and now he is looking for his replacement, or he's coming for Jon Snow? We had kind of a related theory that we talked on the podcast about, essentially that would be kind of like the Pirates of the Caribbean Dead Man's Chest.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That Orlando Bloom was cursed to become the captain of the, what was it, the Davy Jones ship.
That's almost sort of like, it's sort of based on the outcome that we're assuming of this, but I kind of like that theory. Based on my limited knowledge of, you know, the books.
And you can see, like, that was kind of a theme of The Matrix, that Neo was supposed to, merge back to The Matrix so that then another Neo, yeah. Neo could form. Like, this idea of these eternal cycles that you don't understand, and you find out that you're just playing a very small part. Instead of being the clockmaker, you're just a cog in a machine. That's pretty well-worn fantasy and sci-fi trope. And it can be done really great, or it can be done really bad.
Yeah.
But that would be another bittersweet thing if at the end of this, like, they've emerged victorious, but because of some kind of metaphysical rule, John has to inhabit this Night King persona, this mantle, if you will, and retreat back to the North for thousands of years and leave Danny and everybody behind.
Yeah, but specifically about, you know, the last hero and his 12 cronies going up north, never being heard from again, looking very similar to the Night King. I feel like that could be a pretty solid lead on who the Night King is.
Yeah.
What he wants, we don't exactly know at this point, but yeah, maybe he wants Jon as his replacement or something.
Yeah. And, you know, it just depends on how they do that, whether that'd be cool or not, but I could see it. I'm actually starting to feel like 50-50... it might go something like that, where both John and Danny survive, but John is transformed and he's going to be separated from the world of men. But we'll see. Janessa C. On Instagram, I came across a post of all the episodes to rewatch before season 8, according to the writer Brian Cogman. Season 2, episode 9, Blackwater, was on that list. And at the 1443 mark, a light bulb went off. So I paused her email there, and I started this episode, and I played it, and what the scene is referring to is Varys provides Tyrion with a map of what is said to be 50 miles of underground tunnels crisscrossing underneath and in and out of King's Landing, and Varys suggests that this could be used to, that the Targaryens intended this to be used to survive any siege, or Varys said provide a method of escape. As far as we know, Tyrion still has this map, and this is something that Game of Thrones has done before, like sneak in the back door, sneak in through the cisterns, or I knew that. Like, it could be that this is one of Tyrion's last moments, a crowning moment of cleverness where they invade King's Landing through these tunnels.
He needs one. He definitely needs one.
what's your thought on that? Cause
yeah, I mean, they have used, you know, sort of, it's not really a Chekhov's kind of thing, you know, because it doesn't start immediately in Act 1. Although I guess you could say Season 2 of this series is kind of Act 1 for the whole thing. So maybe it is a Chekhov thing. But yeah, they've done this kind of stuff before, right? They did it with the Dragonglass. They did it with... I can't remember. I can't remember another instance, but definitely the Dragonglass. So it's not out of their wheelhouse, and, you know, storytelling in general uses this kind of thing all the time.
The only thing is, I think it's so, they've used it a lot. Like, you know, Dario just happens to know the back door to the city that him and Grey Worm and Jorah can sneak in and unlock the gate. And Tyrion just happens to know the sister.
Oh, yeah, as far as getting into a place secretly.
Yeah,
sure,
through secret thing. It's like, unlike the, you know, like I said, unlike the Brienne using her sword and Arya using her skills as a blood ninja, like, I feel like this is a little bit too much of the same. Like, it's a very particular technique, and it's used by a bunch of different people in a bunch of different circumstances, and Tyrion at least once before. So that's the only reason I would. But otherwise, like, the other obvious thing about why Brian would say that is that the wildfire is going to be a big part of it. Like the Cersei, and we talked about, will Cersei take everybody out with a big wildfire inferno?
Yeah.
Like, why else would you show the Blackwater except for that's the horrifying effects of wildfire seen for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Brian S. wonders, could the Double D still surprise us with a Lady Stoneheart twist? I think we could all agree that everyone's kind of bummed that Lady Stoneheart never made it onto the show. There is a scene in the trailer where it looks like Arya is running through the hallways of Winterfell with a terrified look on her face. What if the Night King makes his way into Winterfell and he awakens Catelyn Stark in her crypt? I feel like resurrecting Arya's mother might be the one thing to scare the shit out of her and then pay homage to the books, but puts an unexpected twist on the Lady Stoneheart character.
What happened to her body?
The
show, I don't think, has really gone into that.
Yeah, I don't think that they've ever established that she made it back to... Unlike Ned.
Ned, we know, did.
They shipped back, and we actually saw his wagon making it to the north, and he does have a crypt down there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. In the books, her body is drugged from the Trident River by Nymeria, Arya's wolf. Mm-hmm. And Arya sees all this through a dream, and then Beric Dondarrion finds and breathes his life into her. He dies, and then Lady Catelyn arises as this horrifying... kind of vengeance zombie.
Yeah.
Which would have been cool.
I'm so bummed we didn't get Lady Stoneheart, but...
Which would have been cool.
Yes, I don't think Catelyn's a super likely possibility, but Ned...
Yeah, I was thinking...
Certainly
he
is.
Should just be Bones, but, like, an undead Ned Stark would be pretty fucking terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how that works when you're beheaded.
I don't know.
Because... That's a tough thing to operate. I guess you just tuck the head under your arm and
go. I mean, I've seen Legend of Sleepy Hollow. I kind of know how it goes.
Yeah.
I think that the thing is there's lore in that all the kings of the north and the lords of the north, their crypts have these like stone statues of them with these iron swords across their lap. And it's said in the books that that's to ward off evil spirits and to contain the restless spirits within the tombs. And I don't know how, because, you know, this is all magic and spiritual bullshit, but, like, it's a kind of thing in fantasy that iron does disrupt. Like, iron and running water is just, like, the devil for magic and spirits and vampires and things like that. So there's the idea that maybe...
I feel like that's a metaphor.
Yeah?
For technology in general.
Oh, yeah,
like,
right.
Dispelling the old myths, essentially.
Because water was, like, the first form of, like, non-human power.
Yeah. And, like, irrigation brought, you know, civilization, essentially. Yep. Yeah.
And then the Iron Age, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The mastery of technology over
superstition, basically.
Yeah, I like that. But the idea is that custom came from the fact that the Night King would come and resurrect all your dead people. and they go rampage through the castle, so like, we better bury them with swords across their lap that shit doesn't happen anymore. So there's a point in its favor, point not in its favor. Moving on to Jared C., has there been anyone else in the history of Westeros who has had a Stark Targaryen blood line besides Jon? That's some powerful mojo. Is there anyone with a bloodline from two powerful houses like that? So... I actually looked this up, and there has never been a Targaryen married to a Stark before. In the Dance of Dragons, Prince Jacaerys Velaryon flew to Winterfell to gain an alliance with House Stark, and he promised a Targaryen princess to marry Cregan's son and heir, but that never came to pass because of the events of Dance. So that's the only instance where it almost happened. There's another instance, which is kind of really interesting. Aegon the Unworthy fathered a whole bunch of what he called great bastards out of wedlock, where he just impregnated, you know, ladies of standing. And then he did the unthinkable, which is he legitimized them all in his deathbed, which caused just a giant fucking civil war between the Targaryens trying to fight over the Iron Throne. One of the great bastards he fathered off of a lady from a great house, the Blackwoods, which are Northerners, and they're descendants of the First Men. And that person became Brendan Rivers, a.k.a. Blood Raven, a.k.a. the Three-Eyed Crow. So the only mingling of First Men and Targaryen blood produced the most powerful Greenseer in the history of ever, until perhaps Bran Stark, so... There's a lot of chosen one.
A lot of juice.
A lot of chosen
lot
one
of
juice bubbling inside John.
Huh.
/ Aegon. So there you go. Jazz W, do you think we'll finally get some Tyrion saddle building now that John is a full out dragon rider? Is that where the where do I hold on comment is going?
I mean, that would be my first request when I get back to Winterfell.
Yeah.
Is like, I need something. If I'm going to keep riding this thing, you can't just be holding on by these flappy horns. You got to build something.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in a Fire and Blood series is that canonically the Targaryens no one bareback dragons. They all had elaborate saddle systems. In fact, there was a system of chains, and you wore a harness, so you chained yourself into the dragon seat, so if the dragon did barrel rolls and shit like that, you wouldn't fall off.
Yeah. Especially in battle.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a really cool scene of the Dance of Dragons where two dragon riders were fighting overhead, and one of them, like, unchained himself and leapt from one dragon back to impale the other with a sword.
Holy shit. Dothraki got nothing on that.
Yeah, it was pretty epic, and everyone died at the end of that particular... Spoiler alert. I think... It seems like it'd be very hard to win that any kind of intense aerial battle or do some kind of Dany's kind of gotten lucky that she hasn't been thrown from Drogon's back,
mm-hmm.
and saddles would fix all that. And yeah. Tyrion's good at making them. So, do you think we'll get Tyrion on a dragon?
At this point, no.
Because, man...
When there were still three dragons on Dany's side, yeah. It was a possibility, but not anymore.
There was a point where he was getting to know the Dany's dragons and Meereen where I thought... the fact that they didn't roast him and kind of accepted them and that they were heading towards that. And I got so excited. But now, unless Dany dies or goes crazy and it's Tyrion and Jon, that would feel really weird for them to hijack her dragons. Though.
It would. Yeah. Kind of dirty. I don't want that to happen.
I feel like, yeah, she, like they took her kids. Like they filed a false report and got her kids taken away.
Yeah.
Although to be fair, she did take her children unsupervised up to the north and got one of them zombified. So maybe DPS, the Dragon Protection Services, need to step in there. Steve G, what role, if any, do you think Baby Sam will play in the war against the Night King?
I don't think Baby Sam has any role, but I could be wrong. I'm open to it.
All right. Well, here's the line of thinking of old Steve. Or young Steve, middle-aged Steve. Steve for all seasons. If you recall that while Sam, Gilly, and the baby were on their way south to the wall from Craster's Keep, the White Walkers were hunting them down with a specific, well, I'll say seemingly specific goal of reclaiming Craster's baby, which they had been denied his offering. Considering the fact that the White Walkers don't try to White Walkerfy every human they come in contact with, because they're usually trying to kill humans, who most of the time return as whites, this would lead you to believe that somehow someone... some babies are more valuable than others, correct? Will it be a goal of the White Walkers to reclaim Baby Sam during their march south as they were cheated out of their offering, most likely in accordance to some pact that's already been much discussed? With so little time left, I'm not sure the Double D's will go this direction, but I would love to see what's so valuable about these babies as opposed to adult humans.
I mean, it is really weird that they have not paid off the turning of the baby scene yet.
Yeah.
Or at least in my opinion, they haven't.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a kind of cool scene to see on its own, but what does it tell us about the White Walkers, more generally? And I can't believe they haven't paid that off, so maybe?
Yeah.
Like, I guess it would be weird if he'd been chasing, the Night King had been chasing that baby the whole time, not Bran, but...
And the longer we get, the more, like, a flashback that would explain that there's this ancient pact, and the First Men are supposed to give some children, and that was the only way the White Walkers can procreate, and we know procreation is, like, the most important thing you can do if you're a creature. Reproduction is important, is all I'm saying. At least it's always been to me. I don't know. I think there's definitely something there. It's just, boy, I feel like that was tracks laid when they had when Martin's bullet points were further in the future, and they were like, oh well, yeah, this will all make sense when Winds of Winter and Dream of Spring comes out, and they never came out, and they're like, ah, fuck, we have. I'll let Martin build that bridge and prune that garden. I'm just going to do my own thing here. But we'll see. We'll see. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms.
Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Before we get to the next point, the next email, I want to tell everybody about our club and the fact that we are running a 25% off annual membership for our club sale. Now, club.baldmove.com is your way to get a bunch of extra audio and video content, including video versions of most of our podcasts. It's the quickest way you can get them. Ad-free versions of the feeds, special bonus things like with our Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy. We're doing live watches and providing commentary for all the movies we're watching. There's special features like Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Just tons of bonus content. If you go to club.baldmove.com, you can sign up for a year of membership and get 25% off, which entitles you to participate in the Instant Talk podcast that we do every Sunday night right after Game of Thrones. That's pretty cool. Also, this is the first club sale that we have that is open to existing club members. So if you'd like to extend, lock in some savings, and extend your membership for up to 5 years, you can do so by going to club.baldmove.com and saving 25% off a fabulous club.baldmove.com membership. Thank you for your support in advance. Dave, with Harry Strickland and the Golden Company now being introduced, I've been thinking of their role in the book series. I haven't finished the fourth to fifth books yet, but I am up on the goings-on. Varys and Illyrio at some point communicate with the Golden Company in the faux Aegon plot. Do you think Varys has already reached out to the Golden Company in the show universe? To what end? I can only guess with Varys. I'm just curious if that connection has crossed your minds.
So certainly not mine, because I'm not super familiar with this material.
Shall I recount it?
That'd be great, yeah.
Okay, so remember we're talking about the Blackfyre and the Blackfyre Rebellion because Aegon the Unworthy legitimized all his bastards. Well, the Blackfyres lost, and they got the ones that were able to escape the wrath of the victorious king were exiled to Essos. And one of the guys whose nickname was Blackfyre founded the Golden Company. Actually, no, his name is Bittersteel. I'm sorry. His nickname is Bittersteel. He founded the Golden Company. And they were behind several, there were several Blackfyre rebellions because they kept coming at it and kept going at it. So the Golden Company was kind of founded under that principle. And there's a lot of theories about like why Illyrio and Varys are doing this. Because if I go back and kind of briefly talk about the history of Illyrio and Varys, Illyrio tells Tyrion that they met when they were both much younger in one of the Free Cities. And Varys was like a pickpocket and a thief, and Illyrio was a sellsword, and they had this thing where Varys would steal important jewelry and artifacts from great houses, and then Illyrio would make a big show of being hired, and I know how to get this, and he would go and return their property, and they'd make money on both ends of that proposition. Then they decided that the real valuable things to steal were secrets. So Varys would start stealing accountant books and diaries and things like that, and start with Illyrio's help blackmail. So in the what Illyrio says they're doing is they've got a Blackfyre Targaryen, or they have a Targaryen that they've been raising in secret. This is actually the other Aegon son of Rhaegar. That supposedly Gregor bashed brains in during the Sack of King's Landing. The secret goes that that baby was secreted out and then carried across the Narrow Sea and has been raised by this other Targaryen loyalist to be like this perfect king. So it could be that Varys, just because he's loyal through the realm and he wants what's best for the kingdom, has been secretly training this super king to come back and bring peace in the realm, or, as some people theorize, this is Varys and Illyrio just running the biggest rip and roll scam on the entire Seven Kingdoms, literally stealing the kingdom and then selling it back to family for power and riches. So that's what's going on in the books. Obviously, in the show, none of this shit's happening. Mm-hmm. None of this shit is happening. It's much like the Dornish plot with the Martells and what they were trying to do, and the secret marriage pact with Dany. Like, none of that shit's happening there. So
yeah.
I think the Golden Company is just a convenient source of the Lannisters to get a bunch of troops after all their shit got burnt on a battlefield, and you already have a mechanism to do that in the books, and you have why not take all the characters in the books and instead of introducing and making up a bunch of new ones? But I don't know. I don't think there's going to be anything to that. Like, I mean, there's only 5 episodes left. Harry Strickland's going to like take his mask off and be like, I've been for the Targaryen. Like, and the other thing is like these Blackfyres, like, I don't think they want just any old Targaryen on the throne. That's one of the other theories, is Aegon's actually not a real Targaryen. He's a Blackfyre Targaryen. So I think those are the problems with the theory.
Yeah. I guess like my biggest question coming out of that is, do you think that, Varys has already seen his end game, which is essentially to be, whether he survives or not is a different question, mm-hmm. but like, as far as how high he's going to rise, what impact he's going to have on the whole situation in the realm, do you think this is where he ultimately ended up on that? Sort of at Dany's side, fighting for a queen that could be good for the realm.
I honestly don't know. I think the answer could definitely be different in the books than on the show.
Yeah,
like in the books, Varys could be a more devious, selfish character, and in the show, he could be more altruistic and loyal. Because it's story, it's not. He's a as important as Varys is to the story. He's still a marginal character.
Yeah, definitely.
So they can, like, marginal characters, you can fuck with their plots and stuff all the time.
And right now he's in the margins. You know, he's doing what he can to help the realm, but he's also sort of in the margins. And I feel like that's where Varys might end up, although he could have some hand in, you know, a character who I view as less sort of in the margins, Tyrion.
Could have
a hand with him taking Tyrion to his end game.
I don't think Tyrion's a mark, because like anyone's got a POV chapter in the books is not marginal. Right. And, you know, Varys doesn't, Tyrion does. I do think that there's this is a theme, because the next email is the same thing. Joseph S. says, any possibility that Dario plays a role in turning the Golden Company? or do you think he stayed where he's told? I feel like there's some tension in the fans that expect there has to be, like, some way to deal with this Golden Company. Like, it has to, like, they can't just be met in open battle. It's got to be Varys buying them off. It's got to be Dario doing the thing that he did with the Sellsword Company in Season 2. It's got to be, it can't be some just, you know, straightforward battle. Like, I don't know what got into the fans that makes them think that the Golden Company is some uber powerful. I mean, they're 20,000 people. So yeah. Depending on how the Battle of Winterfell goes,
you might have that many Dothraki.
Yeah,
pretty easily.
Plus yeah. Unsullied, plus dragons, plus Northmen, plus the Knights of the Vale. Like, you've got, it's the combined might of all of Westeros that's left versus Dany and her hired goons from Essos. So, and they don't even have elephants. If they had elephants, I might take them seriously.
Yeah.
They got no elephants.
I've heard about them, but...
What kind of bullshit elephant can't survive, like, a day sail across the Narrow Sea, too? That's the other thing I want to know.
Yeah, the Dothraki did it.
Fucking paper mache elephants. So, I don't think we're going to see Dario again. I don't think that the Golden Company has to be hoodwinked or swayed or anything like that. But we'll see. We'll see. Marcelep. What is the likelihood that we'll see Howland Reed this season? I feel like the show made a point of mentioning him in the Tower of Joy, but we've not seen him since. It seems like he'd be a good eyewitness to help prove Bran and Sam's claims.
I think those claims are roughly proven.
Yeah. Who are we proving it to at this point?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the North. I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing what the reaction of the Northerners is to this new information that Jon now has. But John's convinced.
Yeah, that's
and
the
he's
thing.
The most important person to convince,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
So I don't really need any Howland Reed, but I get that it would be satisfying for the book people, certainly.
Yeah, it's just so weird because, like, I don't, like, Mira went to go be with her father. I don't expect to see her again, but that's very odd to me. And I don't, because at this point, like, if Howland Reed just, like, if some weirdo old frogman marches into some battle towards the end of the series and, like, I'm Howland Reed, will that be cool? Will that satisfy a book reader?
Oh, and it doesn't have, like, an important role to play?
Yeah.
Just shows up to fight the battle with
like,
him?
Mira showing up would be meaningful. Uh-huh, yeah. Like, you know, she's here to support her old friends, but Howland Reed himself, I don't, it's those weird things, is like, if you, it's kind of like the David Lynch's Dune movie. If you have read the book Dune, you understand what's going on, but you're unlikely to be satisfied with the cliff notes. And if you haven't read Dune, then you just are fucking lost and bewildered. So who the fuck is the movie Dune made for? Like, the people that just want to, like, take a hit of acid and kind of loosely be familiar with Herbert's work and just like, oh yeah, man, how cool to be if your name was a killing word. That'd be pretty sick. I feel like if you put Howland Reed just as like some figurehead of a battle, if you Harry Strickland him, it's going to just piss everyone off and confuse the rest.
No, it's so weird because the source material doesn't exist yet, but like the character does, so he kind of exists. And like normally if you get, okay, Howland Reed's back and the book's been finished and everything and suddenly he shows up in the show, you're going to be like, okay, I know this and this about him. I understand these are some of the things that he does in the source material, so maybe I can look forward to some of that. And it's kind of a big moment with all the possibilities in your head. This is weird because Howland Reed shows up. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to get excited about other than that's a character I know from the book.
Right.
That's literally it.
Yeah.
So why do it?
Yeah. I feel like the last chance we had to see Howland was on the High Sparrow, because there was a cool theory that the High Sparrow in the books is secretly Howland Reed sent to like lead a guerrilla campaign against Cersei as this faith militant.
Yeah, they didn't do that.
They didn't do that in the book, and I think that would have been a cool twist. There was a lot of kind of textual support that might be the case, but they obviously didn't do that in the series. So at this point, if you're going to get Howland Reed, he's it's going to be a last minute. I look. There are ways you could probably do that. because, like, I'm trying to think of other things that seem kind of abrupt and out of nowhere. Oh, like in I can't remember which Lord of the Rings movie, but when Elrond kind of shows out of nowhere to give Aragorn his sword, like, that came out because, like, they're like, oh shit, we need this to happen, and it was supposed to happen this way in the books. We're like a book and a half past this. All right, fuck it. Arwen will just ask her dad, and her dad will do it, and we'll have this, like, 30-second scene of some elves doing some goofy smithing, and then he'll come, and he'll just give it to Aragorn. It's like, okay. But it kind of worked because whatever, and they didn't really make a big deal about, you know, like, it wasn't about the sword, it was more about Aragorn. So I just don't think you can do that with Hal and Reed. So, Natalie A. Or actually, no, it's Nathalie A. Do you think the Red Priest and Priestess will come to the rescue at the end? They have been preaching about Azor Ahai for the entire show, and there's several mentions of, you know, we've seen the Red Priest over in Essos, and the Red Priestesses doing this preaching. Wouldn't it seem like they would want something to do with the war against the Night King?
Yeah, and Melisandre has promised that she's going to have some business back in Westeros, so right. She's got to show up before the end of the series,
right? At some point, I can't remember how long we started doing this, but do you remember the Battles of Westeros game that we used
game?
To play,
the
board game? There was a scenario with the Battle of the Blackwater.
You kicked my ass every time. Melisandre is a beast in that game.
Yeah, and her units are called the Fiery Hand, and I remembered that, so I looked it up. And the Fiery Hand, if I'm going to quote from a Wiki of Ice and Fire. The Fire Hand is a group of slave soldiers employed as guards for the Red Temple of R'hllor in the Free City of Volantis. The Fiery Hand contains 1,000 soldiers, never more and never less. Each of these soldiers is a slave dedicated to R'hllor. They wear ornate armor over their orange robes and wield spears with points shaped as writhing flames. As per the custom of Volantis, these slaves have flames tattooed across their cheeks. I think that'd be cool, but it's 1,000 dudes.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of joked about it, but
all with flaming swords.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I kind of think if they could introduce these priests, especially if they were like shooting fire themselves and every one of these people had flaming spears, like these were literally flaming spears instead of just spears shaped like flames.
Uh-huh.
I think that'd be cool. And I also feel like they've done enough groundwork where they, cause here's the Aaron's philosophy for whether something can happen in a show or not. Can the Double D's in a 5-second previously on clip show something and people go, oh, I know what that is? And I think if they show that, I can't remember her exact name, like Kina Vera or something. If they show one of these Red Priestesses we've met preaching and like gathering this large crowd in Essos, mm-hmm. and then they later show these maniacs storming a beach, people could be like, ah, this is what all the preaching was about. They're raising this fanatical army, and now they're coming to the aid of what they perceive as their savior figure. So I think they could do that in a 5-second previously on.
Yeah, probably. Do you think Dario might be a convert? Dario could be a Red Priest.
I mean, he worships the Mother of Dragons, and she might be the Lord of Light's champion. So
could be. That's how you get your Dario back. Coming back with Melisandre.
Oh boy, can we? I'm wishing mm-hmm. on a bleeding star to get more. More Dario. Nicole K. Cersei sent Euron to Braavos to borrow from the Iron Bank and to hire the Golden Company. Now that Cersei has paid back the Iron Bank, they no longer have a financial imperative to maintain her rule. They're essentially free agents who could choose to invest or not invest wherever they wish. In the books, the Golden Company is started by a Blackfyre Targaryen, and that's the crux of my theory. I do not think the Golden Company is there to fight for Cersei. I think they are hired by the Iron Bank to be a Trojan horse in King's Landing for Dany. The fact they are descendants of Targaryens is poetic justice to help defeat the queen of the usurper, Robert Baratheon. Some of this stuff I feel like we handled, but what is your... If I told you that the Iron Bank, fresh off of Cersei repaying their loans, would then seek to supplant her and raise money for guerrilla forces, what would your response be?
I think it's a real dick move, A. But B... They haven't laid any of this track. They haven't laid any of the Golden Company's history track. We don't know anything about Harry Strickland or how mm-hmm. the Golden Company was started, mm-hmm. You know, as a branch of the Blackfyre Rebellion. Like,
yeah.
None of that is in the show, so I feel like it's very unlikely. That's one of those things you can't do with a 5-second previously on, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the Golden Company didn't exist until
last season.
You could do that
as a 15-minute special feature on a Blu-ray. But...
Yeah, it's not going to help me.
Yeah.
So... I feel like it's very unlikely that they're going to do anything tricky with a golden company like that, but and I suppose not impossible. If you want to devote like 10 minutes of an episode to it, you could.
Well, plus it's like, I think it's bad business for the Iron Bank to do that. It's not just douchebaggery. Like, think
about that was my A point. Yeah.
Yeah. So like the Iron Bank's reputation is you pay us or we will essentially pay the goons to come and extract from you. Right. Yeah. If they do on both sides, like if you don't pay us, we're going to fuck you. And if you pay us, we're going to fuck you.
Yeah. Like, it's like if you had a mortgage with Chase and Chase decided to buy out the rest of your neighborhood and run it into the ground so that your property value went down, then buy it and like rejuvenate it. It's like what's their incentive to fuck you behind your back if you're giving them interest payments?
Yeah,
right?
And who takes and what's and then the next king, why the hell would they take an investment from the Iron Bank?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like it's you gotta have a carrot and stick. You can have stick and stick. So the carrot is they're going to loan money to Cersei to hire the Golden Company. I don't think there's going to be much stick there. Kevin L., if Rhaegar had his marriage to Elia Martell annulled, then is Dany actually a bastard? Is she really Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen, the first of her name, the Unburnt, the Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, Rhoynar and the First Men, Khaleesi the Great Grass Seas, Breaker of Chains and Mother of Dragons? Or is she just Dany Waters? Dany Waters. It sounds like an Eastbound and Down character.
Yeah, that's a bad name.
So I actually didn't know the answer to this, and there's nothing in Game of Thrones lore, as far as I can tell, that would answer this question. So I put on my comparative religion hat, and I looked into what the Catholic Church has to say, because I think out of all the real-life analogs...
Where did you do this? Where...
Google.
There was a written documentation of this. In a book you've written or anything.
No, there was a Catholic information resource I satisfied myself that this is the current answer. And essentially, the Catholic Church's position is if the marriage was valid or putative at the time of a child's birth and they were seen as legitimate, then annulling a marriage does not delegitimize the children in the eyes of the church.
Okay.
But they also say that, like, consult your local laws because they all could vary. And I saw that. So then I went and looked in the United States. It's almost universally the case that if a marriage is annulled, that the children are still treated as, like, legitimate children. And also, as we've become less fucked up as society as we move forward, the idea that inheritance is based on marriage, like, most states recognize illegitimate children's rights to inherit and rights to have, like, there's very few circumstances, like sperm donors can like revoke that and things like that. But like, if you father a child out of wedlock, you are still legally obligated to provide for them and they have a legal claim on your inheritance. So now I couldn't find a great answer for if this is something like, is the church always been this compassionate, or was there a thing where like, well, if the marriage was annulled, then the marriage was never real. And so God knew that these babies were bastards all the time. I don't know. I my research didn't go back that far, but currently it's not. And I also got to think that like, man, so there's the real world explanation. Then you go narratively, that would be super unsatisfying, right? Like, if this comes down to
the
like
technicality,
although
it kind of is with John in way, yeah.
Like, it's the other side of the coin. Like, John's the rightful king, so Dany's got jack shit. Now it's just insult to injury. Also, you're a bastard. You don't get anything,
right?
You don't get Dragonstone. You don't get Storms. You don't get shit. Get out of here.
Keep reading, Sam. You'll figure it out.
Victoria H., is the wall the only thing that stopped the invasion of the Whites during the previous long winter? Is it possible that someone had already killed the Night's King with the Dragonglass thousands of years ago? Maybe future long winters will always bring him back to life. Has any reliable source said there's a way to defeat the Night's King once and for all? Also, with the wall compromised and the Children of Forest gone, is there any way to rebuild the wall to protect the living from future invasions? I mean, the problem here is you're asking questions, Victoria, that happened before recorded history. The maesters obviously have studied this a great deal, and they're highly skeptical of some of the things that have happened in these legends. Like, for example, there are tales from the Age of Heroes involving knights, but the concept of knighthood did not come into Westeros until the
till the Andal invasion that happened like 4,000 years before Game of Thrones. We're talking about things that happened 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, and they're talking about knights. And also some of these knights and kings live hundreds of years and centuries long. They're just normal men. But there's also undeniable, like the wall was built by somebody, and it's an impressive, a lot of the really impressive things that were built in Westeros were built in these time frames, like Winterfell, Storm's End, the Wall. And it's an open question about whether Westerosi could actually build this stuff now. Like, that could be that they've gone backwards, or maybe these ravages of winters have that's one of the theories that, like, why Game of Thrones has been stuck in a medieval age for thousands and thousands of years is because these long winters keep everybody obsessed over surviving the next one, so you don't have time to make real substantive technological and societal progress. So I don't know, how's that, any of that stuff grab you?
Sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know.
But I said, so the last time the Long Night came was before kind of recorded history. So, and he was beaten, but now he's back. Like, as far as I know, there isn't a once and for all, a easy piece. In fact, I suspect that any victory that humanity has over the dead will be a temporary thing. Like, you'll just know that, well, next time. It'll be a strong implication of next time.
That's the thing. It's hard for me to speculate because there's so little information on this in the show as regards the Night King and what he is. And, like, we know the creation of him, but we don't really know all the context around that. So, to say that, oh, yeah, there's a solution once and for all for the Night King and this long winter thing, it's impossible for me, certainly.
Yeah. She also included, and I'm gonna allow it, a PS. I'm reading Gods of Thrones now, and it's an absolute pleasure. The genre blend of academic writing and podcast speak is refreshing. I think we need more of this style in classrooms to get students interested in thinking critically about TV shows and popular culture in general. Funny enough, Victoria, I'm aware of at least two professors in this country that are using these books as part of their curriculum in that kind of pop culture critical analysis type of studies. So
nice,
which is cool. I think it's really awesome. And yes, I love the idea of students being forced to pay for my books to be put
you need
on their
to charge more if it's a textbook.
Yeah, I think
a lot more.
If you go to
$200-$300,
the Google Education, it's a $375. Yes. You can get it in paperback for $16, but the Scholastic version is identical in every way. It's just more expensive for some reason because
the binding is probably stronger. I imagine.
Nah, I just think just that for whatever reason, as a culture, we decided to fuck the young people. Thank you for those kind words. And again, godsofthrones.com. If you would like to get more of that, if you'd like to see what the fuss is about, Jim, I think that's it for this podcast. If you would like to send in feedback for consideration for next week's spoiler edition, it's real simple. Send it to gameofthrones@baldmove.com and hope you arrive at the top of the hundreds and hundreds of emails we get each week. And we appreciate all the people that do send feedback. You also can go on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, and discuss it with your fellow fans. We'll be back Sunday night for the Instant Take, and for club members, the Instant Talk feature, where you can interact with us and ask us your questions live on the YouTube chat format. That happens on Sunday at baldmove.com, immediately after the East Coast airing of Game of Thrones. Anything else that I'm forgetting about?
No.
All right, well, we'll see you Sunday night. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.